This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, the power and pitfalls of patriotism. Has your new flag frayed yet? Are you humming God Bless the USA in the shower? We're talking about how Americans communicate their national pride. Is there a symbolic language that unites and perhaps divides us? First, the Northern Alliance forces in Afghanistan are reporting that they've taken the Taliban stronghold of Mazar-e-Sharif in northern Afghanistan. I spoke earlier with Michael Gordon, military correspondent for the New York Times, and asked him about the latest developments.
The latest report is that the Northern Alliance has taken the city and that the Taliban forces have fled to the east. The Pentagon is being somewhat cautious because they're concerned that if the Taliban aren't to counterattack and if the Pentagon claims too much of a victory, it could be embarrassing for the United States. But the Northern Alliance are entirely categorical. They say they've taken the city.
And they're saying that it's entirely taken. No house-to-house fighting anymore. The Taliban have simply gone.
They say the Taliban fled. They've moved east.
When did this happen? Was it overnight, early morning?
It's happened in the last several hours, really. I mean, this has been a battle that's been going on for a number of days, really, but it's intensified over the last 24 hours. And according to the Northern Alliance accounts, Taliban's simply made a decision that they couldn't hold the city and that they would abandon it for now.
Do we have any idea how many Northern Alliance troops are in Mazar-e-Sharif now?
Several thousand, they say.
And what exactly was the U.S. support for the advance on the city?
U.S. support was air power, which was considerable. Basically, the U.S. provided the close air support for the Northern Alliance, and they also provided the spotters, the special forces personnel that called in the airstrikes.
I know it's always a balance, but does this look like the Northern Alliance really just beat down the door, or is this a strategic retreat on the Taliban's part?
Well, the significance of this development, if indeed the Northern Alliance have taken the city, and we're not there, but it appears that way, but the significance of it is severalfold. One, it is really the first tangible victory for the U.S.-led military campaign. Second, it does cut off the Taliban forces to the east, especially in the Khandos and Talaquan area, because it cuts them off from their supply lines. They're sort of boxed in. So it means that provinces surrounding Mazar-e-Sharif are also likely to fall soon. Also, and this is quite important, it does open up the potential for a corridor supply route from Uzbekistan to Mazar-e-Sharif, and that's critically important for getting food and relief to the millions of people in northern Afghanistan who have been afflicted by the drought. Humanitarian agencies are counting on that. There'll be what is called a land bridge between Mazar-e-Sharif and Uzbekistan. And lastly, it does provide a potential base of operations for U.S. military forces within the country because there's a good airfield at Mazar-e-Sharif. But it's also important what it doesn't mean. This mm-hmm. is a victory for the Northern Alliance in the northern part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the main center of gravity, as they like to say at the Pentagon, is in the south.
Around Kandahar.
Where Kandahar is. That's where the Taliban political base is, and nobody expects the Northern Alliance, even a well-equipped Northern Alliance with U.S. air support, to be able to fight to the south. In fact, it's not even desirable from the U.S. point of view because they represent the wrong ethnic group.
So this solidifies the position of the Northern Alliance in the north, but leaves the real battles for Kandahar and Kabul to be fought.
Right now they have a town, a city
mm-hmm.
of several 2 million,
mm-hmm.
but it could lead to U.S. control of northern Afghanistan, which increases the pressure on the Taliban regime. The next objectives could be Herat. Well, in fact, the Northern Alliance says what the next objectives are. They are Herat in the west and Kabul, the capital. So that's an important development. It's not a knockout blow that will mean an end to the war. There's going to be a whole separate fight in the southern theater, and the Northern Alliance can't play a direct role in that.
So it's a victory for them today, it seems. But how does this fit into U.S. strategy, militarily and in propaganda terms?
Well, in terms of public relations, it gives the United States and Britain a tangible accomplishment that they can point to with their own publics and with the Taliban themselves. As I said, it gives them a potential land corridor to Uzbekistan, which is quite important as the winter sets in, because you need to help the refugees and the displaced people within Afghanistan, because if there were thousands or millions of desperate people, that wouldn't be that would give the United States a bit of a black eye, just as even if it wasn't the United States' fault, but was just sort of an inadvertent consequence of the war.
Any indication from the Pentagon whether they might support a further push now on Kabul before winter sets in?
Colin Powell's on record as saying that he welcomes the Northern Alliance advance toward the gates of Kabul. The American position has been that they don't want the Northern Alliance to enter Kabul proper until there's some arrangement made for a interim regime. Northern Alliance is an Uzbek and Tajik-dominated ethnic group, and the dominant ethnic group in the country are Pashtuns. And so the Northern Alliance is unacceptable to many of the people in Afghanistan. Really, the missing piece in the war strategy is the U.S. is making an effort to mobilize opposition in the south. It's so far largely unsuccessful effort among the Pashtuns to create a resistance movements in the south. That piece is missing. And the U.S. has to find a way to employ its special operations forces because it's not been able to do so since the October 19th raid. So this, what happened today is important, but there's still a long way to go and some other instruments that have to be used, including maybe in the end American ground forces before this is all over.
Michael Gordon is military correspondent for the New York Times. I spoke to him from his office in Washington. Within the last hour, Pentagon officials have said it could take days to fully confirm the Northern Alliance's victory in Mazar-e-Sharif. In his address last night, President Bush urged all Americans to become volunteers in a civil defense service. The president's speech was just the latest call to patriotism.
Oh, can you see?
The moment the second plane hit the second building, when we knew it was a terrorist attack, many felt that our lives would never be the same. But we couldn't be sure of then. And what the terrorists never expected was that America would emerge stronger with a renewed spirit of pride and
After September 11th, flag manufacturers could not keep up with demand. Department stores started selling red, white, and blue costume jewelry, and athletes in the New York City Marathon sprinted under the banner, "United We Run." Americans have responded to the terrorist attacks with a surge of patriotism. But can Americans sustain it throughout a war with few soldiers and no quick end? Is the call to patriotic duty the best inspiration for solving the crisis we're in? 2 months after the attack, how are you thinking about your patriotism? You can join our conversation this evening at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from Philadelphia is Carolyn Marvin. She's professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication and an authority on patriotic symbolism. Her new book is Blood, Sacrifice, and the Nation, Totem Rituals and the American Flag. Good evening, Carolyn Marvin.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
So we're talking about patriotism, and it's all over the place. The flag's hanging from just about every antenna and balcony. Some are starting to blow down and blow through the streets, but it's been an incredible outpouring, hasn't it, Carolyn Marvin? Put this in some perspective for us.
Well, indeed it has been an incredible outpouring and reminds me a lot of the Gulf War when we also had lots of flag display on the part of the citizens.
But more yellow then, or do I have that confused? No, that was the hostages.
That was the hostage crisis, but also the yellow ribbons also appeared with the flag during the Gulf War. It was quite interesting, as though it was sort of filling it out, and it continued to be the case that we had some yellow ribbons, but that hasn't been the case this time.
Where do you see us in this surge, this arc of patriotism? It got launched in the days or a couple of weeks after the 11th. Where are we in the process of patriotic, cycle right now?
Well, I think September the 11th, is perceived as a great injury to the group, and there's concern about whether the group will go on and so forth, and the flags come out and they say the group will survive, the group lives, and so forth. And I think that has to be reinforced fairly quickly with some effort that the citizens can take to further and back up that symbolism that the flag represents. And if that doesn't happen, then the interest begins to kind of wane, because patriotism isn't just a set of symbols. It's a mission. You have to do something. You have to make a public witness that the nation is a moral community where people have moral obligations to each other. So I think there's been there's still a great interest and a great wish that the nation would go forward in this way, but I'm not sure that there's been a message that tells people exactly what to do.
We'll talk about that. George Bush seemed to touch on that last night in his speech, but give us a little more of this definition of patriotism. How are you defining it there, Kellen Marvin?
Well, I think there's a very public component to it. Patriotism is an act, it's a gesture, it's something that you do in front of other people, and you're saying something about the community you belong to. You're saying that it's a community in which people have moral obligations to each other, and you're enacting those, you're acting out those moral obligations. And patriotism is about feeling, and it's about doing.
Acting out those moral obligations. So are you suggesting that when I hang a flag from my front porch, I'm acting out a moral obligation?
Well, you're saying you belong to a community which has a moral obligation, which may be an obligation to sacrifice for the community, that you believe in that community, that we have some responsibility towards each other, and you're glad to be part of that group. I think that's the fundamental meaning of the flag. There's certainly more lighthearted versions of it, and there's critical versions of it, but that's the one that's at the bottom.
Is that why it emerges under threat, or is a threat to the nation the sort of primordial spark to patriotism?
Yes, I think this is a very, very basic language of connection and obligation. And at a time of crisis when the whole group is under threat, that's the time when we signal to each other that we know we have to help each other.
Mm-hmm. So those flags on the bumpers and antenna are a way of saying, I'm part of the nation. I'm with the group. I'm ready to go.
And I'm willing to act on behalf of that belief. That's right.
Mm-hmm. So what about George Bush's speech last night? He talked a lot about service. Is that a way of giving people a path to channel this patriotic energy into?
Yes, I think it is. I think Bush has been looking for a language of patriotism, and it's been sort of hard to find because we're not sending an absolutely huge contingent of troops over to Afghanistan right now, at least. We did in the Gulf War, and so you could see the soldiers go over, and that fulfilling of the obligation was very obvious. But this has been much tougher, and I think Bush has been looking for an activity for people to engage in that will remind them of their obligation. And in a way, the people who have been the most active and the most visible that we see are the firemen and the policemen and the postal workers, the people here at home who protect and serve the community in a certain sense. So Bush is suggesting that we emulate that activity, and we have Civil Defense Corps, and he wants to expand AmeriCorps. And this is all a way of getting people's bodies engaged, getting them something to do. They're not just answering polls, but they're actually acting on their belief that they have an obligation to the community.
Jack Beatty, I've seen you get patriotic in this last couple of months. Not that you're not always, but you clearly respond to the energy, I guess we all do in one way or another.
Yeah, I think that's part of what it means to be an American today. You just can't just sort of opt out of it. You know, this surge of patriotism comes at a moment of civic crisis in America, mm-hmm. a waning of citizenship. Robert Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, gets it. And now we're not bowling alone. For the first time in maybe 20 years, we're all trying to do things in public. And if one good could come out of this war, if it could strengthen citizenship, if it could strengthen those senses, that sense of mutuality that the professor was talking about, that feeling of moral obligation toward the other American, and if these things in turn could sort of enrich and give more content to citizenship, that would be a very significant departure in our domestic political life.
We're talking about patriotism this evening. There's been a great outpouring of it since September 11th. You've You've no doubt felt it yourself. How does it figure in to the nation that we must become to get through this crisis? Are you still feeling patriotic more than ever? Is patriotism the energy that will pull us through? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Or join online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. In 1957, Stanley Kubrick made the film Paths of Glory, a powerful anti-war statement set during World War I. The movie was meant to show how the establishment can generate public patriotism for its own purposes. In the following scene, French General Brulard, played by Adolphe Menjou, tells Colonel Dax, played by Kirk Douglas, that he must lead his unit into a battle that will certainly result in heavy casualties.
More than half my men will be killed.
Yes, it's a terrible price to pay, Colonel. But we will have the anthill.
But will we, sir?
I'm depending on you, Colonel. All France is depending on you.
Not a bull, General. I don't need a flag waving in front of me to get me to charge.
I don't think I like a comparison of the flag of France to a bullfighter's cape.
I meant nothing disrespectful to the flag of France.
Patriotism may be old-fashioned, but show me a patriot and I'll show you an honest man.
Well, not everyone has always thought so. Samuel Johnson had something else to say about patriots.
And what was that, may I ask?
Well, nothing really.
What do you mean, nothing really?
Well, sir, nothing really important.
Colonel, when I ask a question, it's always important. Now, who was this man?
Samuel Johnson.
All right, now, what did he have to say about patriotism?
He said it was the last refuge of a scoundrel, sir.
Patriotism, the last refuge of a scoundrel. We all know that phrase, and we've perhaps felt it sometimes, but in this season, that seems really out of sync. Carolyn Marvin, help us understand. We know there are kind of fluctuating currents or views of patriotism. Sometimes, at the wrong moment, it can seem really out of place. Lately, for many people, it's felt the most important sentiment. What's that dichotomy about?
Well, patriotism is about very serious things because it may require that people die. And, of course, to offer up your children for the good of the group is an incredibly solemn thing to do. So even though patriotism is this sense that we ought to contribute to the group, we have to have a debate about what constitutes the proper kind of obligation. Even the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag says, I pledge allegiance to the flag, but it doesn't tell us exactly what we're going to do when we pledge allegiance. So that's the debate that has to go on, and we can make a terrible mistake if we pick the wrong moral obligation. We can damage our group irreparably.
We're talking about patriotism and how our understanding of it is unfolding in the wake of September 11th. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Are you feeling patriotic? Is it an unfamiliar feeling or one you haven't felt for a while? Is it back? And is it the right sentiment? Will it take us to the best outcome? Jack Beatty, Carolyn Marvin describes patriotism as something that involves sacrifice and often the sacrifice of life. And that we have to think carefully about it before we sort of dive into that pond. Is it beyond debate this time, or does it close off debate somehow?
I hope it doesn't close off debate. I mean, there really are two traditions of patriotism. One is the sort of my country, right or wrong. We saw it in the 60s on those the bumper stickers that said, America, love it or leave it. President Nixon appealed to it when he said the great silent majority was the reservoir of the country's patriotism. He was making silence sort of the test of patriotism. On the other side, there was there's critical patriots, people who say, you know, we're not going to be silent. The country is not living up to its creed. Bombing in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, wherever it might be, is a means that is subverting our ends. These people are not unpatriotic. They just want the country to live up to its professions. And I think those traditions have alternated in the country. And we see now, I think, the first one, my country, right or wrong. But as this war goes on, we're going to have a lot of the second. My country, but no bombing. My country, but no ground war. We're going to hear that, and it's not from people who aren't patriots, but from people who are and who often have to have a lot of guts to stand against the majority.
Carolyn Marvin, how about that? The diversity of expressions of patriotism. Do you, like Jack Beatty, expect it to become richer as we move further from September 11th?
Well, I think that this is a war that's really hard to figure out exactly what the moral obligation ought to be. It's not a war where we're seeing lots of pictures of soldiers so we sort of know what's going on there. It's not a war in which we need lots of citizens to enlist, so it's not exactly clear what the citizens are supposed to do. Bush even had said at a certain point, you know, what we need to do to be patriotic is to go and buy things. And that's a really hard thing to fit into the notion of sacrifice, because sacrifice is about giving up something that's valuable. And it's about not only giving up something that's valuable, but it's a shared sacrifice and a voluntary sacrifice. And that's not really, consumption really doesn't fit that pattern. So it's hard to see it as sacrifice, even though it's an important activity for the whole economy. And I think when Bush said that, for example, he's covering up a hidden sacrifice that he doesn't want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And that is the sacrifice of unemployment. As a result of September 11th, some people have lost their jobs. And, mm-hmm. and this is a terrible thing. But you don't say, you know, losing your job is a real service to your country, because it's not a shared sacrifice. And it's not a voluntary sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And so in order to assist those people who, in fact, have made the sacrifice of their jobs for the country, instead of praising it, Bush tries to think about how to ameliorate it. So he says, you know, we need more activity. We need people to actually go out and buy things. And that may be helpful to those people, but it doesn't really offer us a way to unite as a country in sacrificial terms.
Newsweek's Jonathan Alter writes, "We have been violated, and the flag, like a brilliant dream coat, warms and protects us, at least for now." I expect a lot of people have felt that to some extent. But Carolyn Marvin, does historically, is patriotism also the fuel of good, clear thinking about a crisis?
Well, I think the thinking is, I mean, I agree with Jack that there is a kind of person who will say, I'm going to stand up right now, and my obligation to my country is to say that we're on the wrong path, and I'm going to tell you why I think that is. Mm-hmm. But that's still an action, you know. And there's a way in which patriotism is the part that comes after the thinking. Patriotism is the action that you make after you've thought, the gesture that you've made after you've thought. Patriotism is really about a mission and a feeling.
So it's deciding on what you need or want to contribute and then acting on it.
Yeah, that's exactly
patriotism.
Right. And we can have different ideas about what that contribution ought to be, but the patriotism is the part where you actually show, you know, what your colors are, so to speak. And that makes lots of people nervous, because it does come after the thinking part, and people are sometimes concerned about the fact that people may act without thinking.
That certainly jives with George Bush's big applause line last night, let's roll.
That's the
call to action. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about patriotism. It's more subtle than it looked in the first days after September 11th, but it remains powerful. How are you responding to the calls for patriotism? Are you feeling more patriotic than you have in a long time, or is it not sitting so well with you? Let us know. We have a lot of callers who want to join. Let's go to the phones. Eric is on the line. Welcome, Eric. You're on the air.
Good evening. My name is Eric Weltman. I'm with a peace and justice organization here in Massachusetts called CP PACS.
And all right.
Our concern is that the notion that patriotism means that we need to all stand behind the president, particularly in regard to his horrific bombings of Afghanistan, which we believe are contributing to more innocent victims. And so the notion that we all need to stand behind the president and speak with one voice, which, frankly, we consider somewhat Orwellian, is something that concerns us, particularly when it comes from our other leaders in Congress.
Eric, I understand your point, but let me ask you, what kind of an assault on the country would it take for you to think that it was time to line up behind a leader? Or is there no level of assault that would earn that response?
I mean, we think that any kind of unthinking, uncritical lining up behind a leader, a president, an official, without considering what it is that he or she is actually proposing to do, is unpatriotic, or is simply wrong.
Of course, Carolyn Marvin is saying that the real patriotism is you think and then you act, and that act may include lining up.
It may very well be, depending on what the action is that the president or leader is proposing to do, but we definitely think that what President Bush is doing in Afghanistan is wrong, and there's a sense that I get that people are being intolerant, that patriotism has a hint of intolerance for people who may actually look different and certainly may think different, particularly with regard to, again, what the president and what the Congress is supporting the president in doing. Again, this notion that we're all backing the president, all standing behind the president, we think is wrong, particularly in light of what the president is actually doing.
Eric, thanks for your call. Let me put it to Carolyn Marvin. What about this notion that patriotism, Eric is suggesting, must necessarily contain intolerance? Do you see that? Have you found that?
I think there are some people that believe that the moral obligation to the community demands that everyone stand together and that anybody who disagrees is unpatriotic. That's a disagreement about what the moral obligation entails. There are other people like Eric who say one of the most important moral obligations that we have to each other is to speak our mind and debate this policy and not necessarily go along with the president on everything. And so I'm going to go out in the street and I'm going to make my case and get other citizens to listen to me. That's a different kind of action.
Jack Beatty, this seems like such a classic kind of American tension. On the one hand, wanting to line up for the country and its ideals. On the other, not wanting to be herded into anybody else's parade.
Yeah, and it's gone right through our wars. I mean, notably in World War I, where some intellectuals, validating intellectuals, as we might call them, jumped on the bandwagon of the war and said, this is a war for democracy. We've got to support it. We're going to be with the president 100%. And those who aren't are, are proto-German. And, of course, one of the most distinguished of those is Randolph Bourne, a man with severe disabilities who wrote scathing articles about the conformity of the other intellectuals to the war. And he wrote, "War is the health of the state." And he sort of pictures war as itself a kind of Moloch, that using the emotion of patriotism, what he called the cheap emotion of sacrifice, can actually devour lives. It can be about killing and mass death. And in that sense, this good emotion, patriotism, unless somehow curbed with mind and with conscience, can result in, it can feed this monster war, which always is the health of the state, which makes the government bigger than ever and makes us. So I think we're in war with ourselves, too, between our impulses of solidarity and our other impulses of criticism and, wait a minute, is this the path we want to go down? And also our feeling that on the one hand, we're Americans, but we're also human beings. We're part of the species. And we have obligations that transcend our borders, too.
And what about this time in this particular tragic season, Carolyn Marvin? Are Americans as at war with themselves as they sometimes have been over this issue of patriotism? Of course, in the Vietnam War era, it was a hugely divisive point. But this time, is there more unanimity or?
Well, I think that we haven't really seen the anti-war movement get its feet under it yet. And that is, of course, this whole business is very young as well, too.
Are you suggesting it's inevitable that it will?
No, I don't think it's inevitable at all. I don't think at this point the American public's opinion is fully informed about what's going to happen with respect to their support of the president's policy. I think people are waiting to see what the president is going to ask them to do. I think people are going to wait to see what they think is the outcome of the policies that the president is engaged in. But everybody's got a big stake because it isn't just a matter of opinion. Things actually happen as a result of your opinion in this kind of emergency. So we have real concern on the left and real concern on the right about what people might do as a result.
We're talking about patriotism and its place in the current crisis. How much are you feeling? Is it as strong as it was on September 20th? Is the flag still waving from the antenna of your car? Are you going to keep it there for the duration? It may be a long war. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. Talib is on the line. Welcome, Talib. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I just wanted to say that I appreciate your show. I appreciate the topic. I'm feeling more patriotic than I've ever been. I'm an African-American living in the inner cities of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to add to the conversation is, in order for us to keep the patriotism going, or in order for us to sustain the patriotism that we're going to need to not only get through the war, but get through what happens after the war, there needs to be a higher degree of inclusiveness of different cultures, peoples, ethnic backgrounds. And that's what I'm most proud of America regarding this war, regarding this instance, is that there seems to be a degree of that inclusiveness. Like when this originally happened, when mm-hmm. we were going to bomb Afghanistan, I heard of people making sure that Muslims in the community were protected and were safe, and people were walking Muslim women home and so forth and so on. And being a Christian myself, I mean, you know, I see that as a being the highest form of sacrifice is making sure that the people in your community are safe and they feel included within, you know, within that community.
So you're feeling an embrace within this patriotism, a kind of a unity.
Yes, but here's what it needs to be intensified, and I'd love to hear it from Bush's mouth more, how we really need to reflect on our foreign policy. We really need to reflect on our domestic policy and ways it may marginalize people of you know, non-white, non-Euro backgrounds, mm-hmm. And non-middle-class backgrounds. I think that sort of inclusivity, that sort yep. of debate would definitely sustain a patriotism and make me and the people that I represent feel like they want to defend America even more.
We got it, and we thank you for your call, Talib. What about it, Carolyn Marvin? The Bush administration has been pretty effective after a couple rocky days in pulling the flag of patriotism around diversity, particularly when it comes to getting Americans to chill about the Muslim American fellow citizens and reducing hostility. In fact, extending an embrace.
That's been in there from the very beginning, and people have commented on that. And also this business last night when Bush talks about helping out public safety agencies in your own community and hospitals, and all that's a way, as you say, of wrapping the flag really around the community and having it help itself, as the young man who just called suggested. Now, if, in fact, as a result of the bombing, if that intensifies over a long period, if the Taliban proves a tougher enemy and the military efforts go on, it could be that people would begin to have more hostility towards members of the towards members that weren't in the group and so on. But right now, I think that's one of the real strengths and credits of the country and in the administration is the effort not to isolate people within the United States, but to actually try and get them together. Now, of course, the civil libertarians are worried about the ways in which measures have been implemented to detain people for interrogation and questioning, and that's an ongoing thing that the community has to watch to make sure that that doesn't become an implement to divide people in ways that are unfair and unjust. But in terms of saying we should not be isolating people because of their ethnicity or their religion, I think the whole community gets very strong marks for arguing in favor of that inclusiveness.
We're talking about patriotism and the role it's playing in the current crisis. There's a lot of it out there. You've no doubt felt it yourself. Is patriotism the energy, the inspiration that will pull us through this new challenge? Is it the well that you're looking to pull up that strength to go the distance, as President Bush says? When President Bush says, let's roll, do you see rolling with all flags flying? Call us at 1-800-423-8255 or online at WBUR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be back after just a short break. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about patriotism in the wake of September 11th. Are you drawing energy from patriotism? Let us know how it's factoring, how it's figuring in your life. How do you think it's propelling the national conversation about what's going on in the direction you'd like to see it go, or maybe something else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joyce is on the line. Welcome, Joyce.
I'm wondering whether we're not really drowning in a glut of red, white, and blue, over-commented on, over-purchased. I think when I saw the fellow at the lecture with the flag socks, that was probably a turning point.
Right down to his socks, he was a patriotic American.
Well, no, but there is that quaint custom of revering that particular arrangement of stars and stripes. And the quaintness of talking about flag etiquette makes it very distant. And I think that our current being awash with red, white, and blue everywhere, inescapably, is kind of a desperate decor that masks a general terror. And perhaps we should just step back, perhaps learn a bit more about the American experiment, read American history with some sense of affection and simply staunchness and a bit of courage. I'm really shaken by Charlotte Beers, and I don't know what her title is.
The Madison Avenue guru who's now guiding our PR effort nationally to the world.
Exactly. And when she speaks about selling brand America, I think this is the terror of utter commercialization.
But Joyce, would you take the socks right off that guy? I mean, if he's terrified and that comforts him, is it a bad thing?
I would say the American flag is not a security blanket. It should be regarded with some dignity and distance and not drown us in it.
Joyce, thanks very much for your call. Jack Beatty, a lot of American writers have taken a rather sour view of patriotism, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And there's a classic passage from A Farewell to Arms, an anti-war novel by Ernest Hemingway published in the wake of the First World War. The character, Frederick Henry, his colleague, he's an American fighting in the Italian army. His friend, an Italian, says to him, "We won't talk about losing. There's enough talk about losing. What's been done this summer cannot have been done in vain." And this is Frederick Henry talking. "I did not say anything. I was always embarrassed by the words sacred, glorious, and sacrifice, and the expression in vain. We had heard them, sometimes standing in the rain, almost out of earshot, so that only the shouted words came through, and had read them on proclamations that were slapped up by bill posters over other proclamations. Now for a long time, and I had seen nothing sacred, and the things that were glorious had no glory, and the sacrifices were like the stockyards at Chicago, if nothing was done with the meat except to bury it. There were many words that you could not stand to hear. And finally, only the names of places had dignity."
Ernest Hemingway. That, of course, is at a different point in the cycle. That's deep into the war and the blood and the sacrifice, Jack.
That's right. But, you know, the whole tradition, the whole anti-war tradition, anti-World War I tradition, was a kind of reaction by the part of American writers after the war to the way the war was sold and to the way that Woodrow Wilson cast it as a crusade to make the world safe for democracy. And, of course, that is the trouble with these ultimate war aims, that when they fall short, they can produce a kind of acrid disillusion. And Mr. Bush has cast this war very high. This is a war to eliminate terror, to make freedom secure. And with such high aims, means that seem shabby can seem, you know, the kind of thing that writers later on will feel disillusioned
all
about.
Over. Let's hope it doesn't get shabby. I want to try and get one more quick call in before we go.
Can I say something to Joyce about her?
Is this Courtney? I'm sorry, Carolyn.
Yep.
Sure, to Joyce.
Sorry.
To Joyce, who has enough of red, white, and blue socks.
Yeah, who thinks it's a security blanket. Jack had said that, you know, there's two kinds of patriotism, and he referred to a sort of a critical patriotism and a United We Stand patriotism. But, you know, there's two kinds of flags as well, and one of them is the sort of high sacrificial flag that Joyce is talking about, that's the most formal flag and in the ceremonies and very solemn, and we can't touch it, and it's a sacred flag, really, in many ways. And then there's another kind of flag, and that's the flag in the flag socks, you know, and this is a flag that is constantly rearranged and reorganized by the people who are symbolically remaking the community. They can touch it. It is a security blanket. It's a very energetic, creative, popular kind of flag. It has a million different forms and shapes, you know, and I think that that kind of energy is actually very valuable at symbolizing the vitality of the community and the diversity of the community. So I don't see it quite the way she sees it.
Carolyn, what do you think when it gets further into the mercantile and commercial world? I see a full-page ad in the New York Times in front of me here from yesterday. "We are cheeseburgers and fries. We are restaurants, part of America, in red, white, and blue." You've seen a lot of that. Is that just commercial? commercial world chipping in?
Well, of course. Everybody wants to play. You know, the American way of life refers to furnishing and feeding and nourishing and...
Is that playing or is that mooching off of a deep sentiment?
Well, you know, I think that there's a place for both things. I don't think that we have to say that people who engage in commercial transactions have no patriotic contribution mm-hmm. to make. I'm not sure that's a good thing to say. Mm-hmm. We're worried that money will tarnish the flag. The wrong kind of money will tarnish the flag, just like we're worried that the wrong kind of blood and death will tarnish the flag. But it isn't the case that commercialism itself is utterly inconsistent with American activity that's actually quite essential. And
Carolyn Marvin, our time has run down, but keep following it, keep tracking it, and come back and talk to us again about it. And thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Carolyn Marvin is professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. She's author of Blood Sacrifice and the Nation. Jack Beatty, final thoughts?
Well, I leave it to Joyce, a caller who was saying she's had enough of red, white, and blue, and she sees a defensive feeling in all the flags. She speaks of the flags as a desperate decor that masks a general terror. And I think there is a lot of that. If we can hold on to this symbol, somehow there isn't anthrax. There aren't terrorists out there. We're safe. But
and yet you hate to take the red, white, and blue socks right off that guy if they're keeping his feet warm in this cold winter.
Yeah, absolutely not.
You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, how September 11th has changed what Americans read. Today, the number one paperback nonfiction book on the New York Times bestseller list is the 19-month-old book Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. When it came out in April 2000, one reviewer called it a story that needs telling to a wide audience. As special coverage correspondent Jonathan Salzman reports, the terrorist attacks have breathed new life into old books and given birth to a host of new ones.
Okay, here you go. Thank you.
Christine Connors has worked in bookstores for 12 years and currently manages this store, Books on the Square, in Providence, Rhode Island. She's seen plenty of books propelled onto the bestsellers lists by big news events, say, the death of Princess Diana and the impeachment of President Clinton. But she's never seen anything quite like the impact of September 11th. 2 months later, her customers are still hungry for books about terrorism, Middle Eastern affairs, and Islam. So hungry that the store recently set up a display table with 20 or so of the most popular titles. Connor says the books are serious works of reporting or scholarship, not the kind of stuff likely to be picked by Oprah's book club.
We do have Edward Said's Power, Politics, and Culture interviews with him. The New Jackals has been very popular. It's primarily on bin Laden, but there are others that are included in that. It's just sort of the future of terrorism. Karen Armstrong has been very hot. She's a former nun who writes a lot of books on The Battle for God is one of her titles. History of God is another. Islam, a history. She basically talks about the three fundamental religions.
Connor says the sudden appeal of these books and others like the Quran reflects a deep yearning to somehow make sense of the terrorist attacks.
I think that people want to be informed, as well informed as they can on the subject, whether it be to prepare themselves for what's coming or just to concentrate on something. They feel helpless. And I think trying to gain knowledge is their only option.
The buying trend at Books on the Square mirrors a national phenomenon. 4 of the top 15 nonfiction bestsellers listed in today's New York Times deal with the terrorist attacks, the World Trade Center, Islam, or the Middle East. 6 of the 15 best-selling nonfiction paperbacks also deal with those subjects. Some bestsellers, like Germs, A Chilling History of Biological Weapons, were in the publishing pipeline when the terrorists struck. But others were several years old and hastily reordered or reprinted to capitalize on the surging interest. For example, number 6 on the Times paperback bestsellers is Thomas Friedman's From Beirut to Jerusalem. It was first published in 1989 to critical and commercial acclaim. In the year before September 11th, Books on the Square sold no copies of the award-winning book. Since then, the store has sold 10. The sales record of another book, Bin Laden, The Man Who Declared War on America, is even more dramatic. This biography, by terrorism expert Yosef Badansky, was first published in 1999 and sold a modest 10,000 copies. The publisher, Prima, planned to reprint it in paperback next spring and hoped to sell about 20,000 copies. But after September 11th, Prima rushed it to print and had it in stores a week later. Now it's number 3 on the Times bestseller list, and Prima expects to sell 300,000 copies. Matt Jarrett, a publicist for Prima, says he would have laughed if someone on September 10th had predicted the paperback's remarkable success.
I would have said I was, you know, not believed it at all.
Jarrett says the book is heavy reading, full of details and dates. Prima originally figured it would appeal to policy wonks, not the general public.
It's just so specified. People who are interested in really hardcore policy-type books would be the core audience for this book. But you would really have to have kind of knowledge of other affairs going on abroad to really get that much out of it.
Now the Bin Laden book is expected to be one of Prima's biggest sellers ever. The rush to get terrorism-related books into the hands of eager readers means a lot of work, of course. For authors who have to quickly finish works in progress or add fresh material to new editions, for publishing houses which edit the books, and for people who print and bind them. About a week after the terrorist strikes, this printing company housed in a cinder block building in East Greenwich, Rhode Island, got a call from a New York publisher. Powerhouse Books wanted Meridian Printing to quickly print a photo book chronicling the attacks on the World Trade Center. Daniel Frank, Meridian's director of fine arts publications, says a six-color printing press ran round the clock for 2 weeks, except for two short breaks on Sundays, so Meridian could complete the run of 114,000 copies on October 29th.
This is actually the press that printed the book. It is our fastest press, and so we devoted one printing machine for the book, since we had to keep our other two presses open for other jobs.
Frank says Meridian initially hesitated to do the job because it didn't want to appear to be profiting from the September 11th catastrophe. The firm took the job after management decided that Meridian would donate its $30,000 profit to a September 11th relief fund. The firm's press workers also donated their weekend overtime pay to the fund. One of the press workers, Kevin Rep, says the job was tiring, but it gave him a preview of the gripping pictures taken by world-renowned Magnum photographers of the World Trade Center disaster.
You know, you get to see some things that you can only think about. You know, you see them on TV, but then you get to see some of the real photographs, you know, of what it really is. I couldn't imagine what some of these people were actually going through.
The book, which is titled New York, September 11, is tentatively scheduled to go on sale next Friday. So, does the smashing success of the terrorism-related books signal a seismic shift in readers' tastes? Or are books on the Taliban, Osama bin Laden, and Islam merely a fad, though a highbrow one, like the torrent of books published after the death of Princess Diana? Paul Bogards, the director of publicity for the publisher Knopf and a 20-year veteran of publishing, says the new books are no fad.
These books will have, in fact, staying power. And the reason they'll have staying power is because this event that you're talking about isn't really an isolated event. I mean, the event of 9/11, okay, yes, it was a mass act of terror on the United States, okay? Subsequent to that, though, we have gone to war, and it is unlikely that this war is going to end next week or next month or even next year. And people are, in fact, going to want to come to terms with it, and they're going to turn to books for that.
For special coverage, I'm Jonathan Saltzman.
For comprehensive coverage of the War on Terror, go to our website at WBUR.org, click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.